Let me just to get the background for the 1970s. You had low unemployment in the late 1960s. Inflation rises. They say, well, this is because of the Phillips curve. The unemployment rate's low, inflation's high. And then you see that like the Fed did not raise interest rates enough to check inflation down. Because of that, inflation stays high. And the real lesson is the Fed should have been hiking rates to get inflation under control in the late 1960s. Because if you don't, then you get these spirals, and it just kept going for decades and decades. Because unemployment went down below its natural rate, right? Unemployment down below its natural rate, time to start, you need to be raising interest rates. And if you don't, inflation expectations are gonna get under control. That kind of happened in the 50s, but inflation didn't get out of control. Unemployment fell to a really low level, lower than in the mid 1960s. Unemployment fell. Inflation had a surge. That surge happened around the Korean War. It happened kind of front running a lot of wage and price controls that people were anticipating related to the sort of Korean War. So inflation went up to double digits in the early 1950s. And then it came down. And what's the disciplining device here? Interest rates barely moved. The Fed technically bumped up rates a little bit, but nothing nearly proportional to the surge in inflation. There was no Volcker shock that came in. So what's your story for how inflation just came down on its own? I've heard a couple of things.
Welcome to Reviving Growth Keynesianism, a podcast about economic thought from the mid-20th century and why it matters to us today. Our goal is to fan the flames of a growing conversation on inequality, growth, and aggregate demand, so that we may hopefully arrive at a place of better well-being for all.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Nick Johnson, and I'm coming to you today from the University of Chicago's Center for Spatial Data Science.
And I'm your co-host, Robert Manduca, coming to you from the Department of Sociology at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us.
Today, we're joined by Skanda Amarnath, who is the executive director at Employ America. We are here to take a step back from the messy world of today, where the facts and trajectory are often so uncertain, to re-examine inflation's past. As we've discussed many times on the podcast, memory is a causal force in political economy. The way the past gets interpreted and then embedded into common sense and assumptions in formal models winds up implying that the myths get acted out in policy decisions every day. So interpreting the past matters a great deal. And doing that well means knowing a lot about the institutions and events and anxieties that actors faced in the past when they generated the data that macroeconometricians use to estimate their models. So we thought it would be good to talk to one of the leading post-Keynesian analysts of policy on the front lines in DC today. Skanda, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So glad just to start off, maybe we can get to know you a little bit better. What was your path into macro and into your current position as executive director?
Sure. So I think my path to macro starts in about my sophomore, junior year of high school, where I, that would have been right around the time the housing bubble had burst and the financial crisis seeds were being sown in what was going on in the news. And if you were paying attention closely, and I started competing in these competitions called Fed Challenge at the high school level and then at the college level subsequently. And so I got steeped in macro at the time that the sort of financial crisis was getting going. And there were this corner of bloggers and commentators who were really on top of things and could give you a great description of why things were going to unfold the way they did. They subsequently made their commentary may not have been quite so stellar, but at least in the time there was, their description of why things were so fragile and what were the implications were right. And they were kind of in contrast to another set of, I would say a broader set of economists who are pretty sanguine about the risks. And so I got really interested in macro in that episode of history and economics. That macro itself kind of caught my interest was sort of a function of I was sort of more quantitatively inclined, but also very interested in historical and political development. I think that's a story that's pretty common across a lot of people who are interested in econ in various ways. Now, whether they end up being a PhD economist or not, it's a different question. But in any case, that's where I sort of got my interest. And I had continued to compete in college Fed Challenge competitions and also coached College Fed Challenge for almost a decade subsequently. And after college, I worked at the New York Fed for 2 years as a research analyst, doing things that were probably more of a training ground for people who wanted to become PhD academic scholars. After those 2 years, kind of doing something in macro finance, which was the area of my greatest interest, I learned a lot from the New York Fed, and I learned a lot of the useful things just in terms of rigor and some things on the policy side that were very useful. But then I went to work for a hedge fund, and that was actually more my speed, I would say, a macro hedge fund where I was a market economist and a market strategist, kind of focused on like US and to a lesser extent, even Canadian sort of interest rate markets and over fixed income. And I was also focused on like their macro economy and like how are the two integrated together? Well, how does the macro matter to the markets and how do markets matter to macro? And I also got exposed at that time. It was probably like the commodity super cycle was turning the other way. The oil prices were collapsing. Global growth was really slowing down. There was a lot of things. It was just interesting to see the kind of, you learn a lot very quickly in those episodes that you may not otherwise grasp. And I generally, genuinely very grateful for the experience of working at a hedge fund because it actually kind of forced me to revise a lot of priors in real time very quickly. You have to kind of, like finance, kind of forced to have a lot of hypothesis tests and quickly admit you're wrong and move on. And not just move on, but also like, you can't just say, oh, my theory is right. And I just had to like change these other parameters in the theory and I would have been just fine. You're kind of constantly forced to like face the facts if you're really intellectually honest and say, okay, I got that. My priors need to be revised, but my theory also probably needs to be tweaked in this way. If I can't really, if I'm relying on like residuals to kind of explain certain phenomena and I have to rely on them more and more and more, then I think I have something pretty flimsy as far as theory goes. And that's kind of how I got into post-Keynesian economics and some of the ideas that were most relevant and powerful and most effective for kind of filling in the areas that I thought were a lot of gaps. I was told a story about how inflation expectations were pretty important for inflation. And then it turns out like most of the observable measures of inflation expectations are not very good at forecasting inflation. This is something Jeremy Rudd wrote a whole paper about that got a lot of airplay, Jeremy Rudd being a famous Fed economist. But I think it's something that like, if you talk to people who are inflation forecasters who get paid to like have informed views about inflation and try to get the next set of inflation prints right, they'll tell you that something pretty similar, which is like none of the observed estimates of expectations are particularly compelling. I'm talking about like financial market pricing or consumer surveys or business surveys. Likewise, there's a lot of things about like who controls interest rates, right? Like long-term interest rates, how much of that is a function of like some sort of vague supply-demand forces? Like there's this demand for this exogenous demand for US treasuries. There's apparently this sort of like savings that are built up somewhere. And you're kind of told these stories about how like the supply of treasuries and the demand of treasuries are always interacting at certain prices. It's all very like vague. How am I supposed to observe this stuff? But there are like more straightforward theories about like how is money created? How is like public finance work? That I think is more descriptively accurate. It doesn't mean like it's a, or like how money is created in the real economy in terms of some ideas that are kind of, I think have their roots in a lot of post-Keynesian ideas, at least in terms of like endogenous theories of money, sectoral balances. There's a lot of stuff around like even the relevance of things that may seem trivial, like Cambridge capital controversies. These are all kind of arcane ideas, but they have some salience for how you evaluate the macroeconomy in real time if you're kind of a careful observer and you're willing to revise your priors. So I've come to those views largely not, like I think my politics have changed over time in certain ways, but I think the main reason I got attracted to these, like you could have there are a lot of people who are on a certain side of the political spectrum who have very different descriptive views about the economy and descriptive views about the macroeconomy. So I think the descriptive usefulness and accuracy is part of why I got into that space.
After a few years, more on observables than unobservables, and
make better prediction. Yeah, we're always relying on observables and unobservables, but the weight should always be towards the observables. That's I guess the best nuanced way to put it. Like yes, there's a fudge factor in every model, but you don't want to lean on your fudge factor too much because then you have nothing. And I think if you're like, there's a speech Jay Powell gave in like August 2018, where he's, you can read it as him being very charitable to those who are in the macroeconomic community. He's like, ah, these stars, and by stars, I mean these unobservable variables of like, what's the natural rate of unemployment and what's the like true expectation of inflation and what's the real natural rate of interest. These are all like vague quantities. And he's like, says like, this is kind of like astronomer, like navigators
navigating the stars
and then right. moving around. And it's like, okay, astronomy is a pretty charitable way to describe this stuff. It's like, you can kind of vaguely use it to chart your course. Astrology might be a little more cutting, but it might be a little bit better way to describe some of this stuff. I mean, it's kind of vaguely true in a post hoc sense, like, ah, like we had more inflation than we otherwise would. So we would have had less inflation if employment was lower and unemployment was higher. It's like, I guess that's kind of true, but it's like a very like, thank you for telling me this after the fact. It's also not necessarily helpful for where I'm going in the future. I think that describes a pretty big problem in a lot of macroeconomic analysis that's used for real-time purposes. And I think one thing that, to be fair, and this is, I think, an area where the Fed is a little bit more self-aware now than they probably than like much of the macroeconomic commentariat at large, is like, there are different decisions and different types of analysis and insights that are useful for real-time, like using the data that's right in front of me, versus like an academic setting where it's like, we're just working from a data set that exists. We already know the data is not going to be revised. There's not going to be some new changes. There are not these like big sources of uncertainty that I have to grapple with in real time. How do I hedge my risks against these types of scenarios? I think that's something that, that's why I think you do see the Fed is a little more intellectually flexible than maybe your most prominent macroeconomists might otherwise be. So that's kind of that's what I would say there. And as far as like from there, from being at a hedge fund for about 4 years, I then had the opportunity to work and like help start up Employ America. Mm. And the goal of Employ America was to like have an organization that could advocate clearly for the macroeconomic policies that would help promote and sustain tighter labor markets. And by tighter labor markets, I mean the conditions that kind of describe right now to a large degree, which is employment is high and can move higher. And workers have more bargaining power because they have more ability to, more options and more opportunities to find jobs that suit their abilities. So it is meant to be both. And I think that's something that we are trying to find that there's, the macro is probably underrated towards those goals. I mean, yes, it's not a panacea. You don't want to make the argument that it's like the only thing that matters for where wage and employment outcomes are, obviously, but also it can help to facilitate a lot of change in terms of what helps support like changing labor conditions, labor laws. What's it going to take to get to the point where people start to see the value of labor and not view it as a cost that must be expunged from like every single business's balance sheet?
It does strike me, though, as at least somewhat unintuitive, the move from being a hedge fund guy to advocating on behalf of workers and a strong labor market. So what was the transition there? I mean, other than the descriptive accuracy of post-Keynesian economics, what informs your preferences for a strong labor market and those at Employ America?
Oh, I think that's...
Or is it just straightforward that it's good for most workers?
I think my politics have been shaped over time. Like I think I had, when I first got into macro, I was probably, this is again, like I was a teenage libertarian, right? So it's not exactly, there's a lot of kids who are like teenage libertarians and kind of like takes a sort of like world historic crisis of the kind that we had. And you start to see a lot of these ideas are kind of flimsy and you need, and like, I think I probably went from somewhere from there to something a little more center left. I think some might call it just like technocratic neoliberal, to someone who's a little bit more appreciative of like some of the flaws there too, hopefully. And yeah, so my political
social stability.
Yeah, I tried to be, I think one thing I want to reiterate is like, I think as like Employ America, I think we obviously have, we tend to be ambitious in our views about labor markets and labor market outcomes. And I think we want to like see this, the conditions for workers to broadly have meaningful bargaining power and meaningful participation. That I think is something that's really important. But there's actually like a pretty broad group of people who can rock that, right? In some ways, I see a lot of the fights between people who call themselves social democrats and people who call themselves neoliberals. And I think like, you guys are probably speaking more of the same language than you realize on a lot of these things, but you are kind of caught up in some level of identity around these descriptions that are just not necessarily constructive. And I think like there's a lot of different people from different stripes. And like, I mean, even like if you want to functioning like macroeconomic policy institutions and have macroeconomic policies that can really support like a, like I think a lot of people say they really care about labor force participation, right? Like they say, it's what we need is more labor supply, they'll say, or we need to address labor shortages, or wouldn't it be great if we had higher employment? Like no one really thinks higher employment's bad unless like you're like in generally that's like probably fine. Obviously we don't want like kids working and we don't want like the senior citizens to have to work. like these things are not desirable, but like by and large, like if you look at like people who were in their prime working years, like it's definitely been feasible to have like more people work who want to work. I don't really think like the argument, the only people who really think that like work is something to be eschewed in some deep sense is like if you look at a labor leisure trade-off model in which like economists are saying, oh well, everyone's probably withholding their labor because they enjoy too much leisure and they're just trying to like maximize leisure to no end. I think most people prefer to have a job available. Some people hate their jobs and jobs are of low quality, but that's not the same thing.
Yeah.
And
so the biggest constraint on running labor markets tight these days, it seems to me at least, is concerns about inflation in the 1970s. Sure. It's this big bugaboo that just sort of, for an entire generation, right, scarred them against a certain kind of macroeconomic policy. So it might be good to just rehash real quick, you know, what are some of the myths out there? What do you hear on the front lines in terms of when you talk to policymakers or other economists who are afraid of inflation today? What are the mechanisms that they're worried about, and specifically the ones that you might have reservations about or disagreements with?
Yeah, I think you're told a story that's largely about a kind of wage price spiral, and one in which the wage price spiral we're talking about, obviously, something happens that makes businesses set prices higher, and then that forces them to pay workers more, and then where workers demand higher wages. And then because workers demand higher wages, then that also leads to firms being pressured to raise prices again. And then this just kind of keeps going and going and going ad infinitum. And it takes like a big bad central banker to kind of hammer those expectations down again, right? And it's like expectations. That I think of the expectations, like it's, there's probably ways to rescue the idea of expectations. But I do think it's very problematic that we have never really actually had economic agents reporting their inflation expectations. And economic agents, businesses, households, maybe even financial market traders and investors, what were their expectations during the 70s? Like we didn't actually get that. This was a story that was told largely because the Phillips curve, the correlation between the unemployment rate and inflation, that was like briefly looked very strong for about 10 years, broke down in the late 60s and throughout the 70s. There was a Phillips curve sort of view of the world. And if you thought like, okay, the Phillips curve didn't really hold up well, let's here think of a way we can rescue this, like where inflation can trend even when like the Phillips curve might suggest something else. And we'll call that thing that's trending, that is auto-correlated, meaning it's kind of moving over time in a certain direction. That's like a function of where it, like if inflation is high yesterday, it's going to be high tomorrow, right? It's kind of like, that's just kind of what happens. And inflation is just trending upwards. That trend, we're going to just call that expectations. Mm-hmm. We never really like pinned down what this is. And it's kind of, we should be a little more skeptical of this given how much of, we don't really have, you would think if that theory was really strong, all of the measures of expectations we have now, and we have a lot of them actually. We have a lot of consumer and household, like consumer household level measures. We have business level measures. We have, all sorts of things regarding financial market prices, your inflation-linked bonds. There are a lot of people who could make a lot of money if they could nail in like their like forecasts of inflation. Mm-hmm. And we don't have like a great way of predicting inflation through this mechanism. It's very unsatisfying. Now, people will say, well, that's because central bankers got the magic sauce going and they got like...
they've controlled expectations
like,
sufficiently
they've well. They've controlled expectations so well, you can't even like... pick it out now. It's like, it's the, how How convenient. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, the efficient central banker hypothesis or something like that.
I think that's a very good description of like what this is. It's like, oh, we just silenced this to such a perfect degree that we're not even noticeable. It's like, that's a very charitable way to describe, like, you don't even notice like how important I am. Like that's, I'm so important, you don't even notice me because I did such a good job of hiding it away. I think this is not very, if it is true, it is true in a very just so post hoc sense.
Right. So the other part of this expectation story is that it's expectations about aggregate demand and fiscal policy and monetary policy that sort of set off the spiral generally, right? Or that's the worry.
I think it's actually that workers, like you can call it unions and businesses, if you want to try to put the political veil on. So like there is this tension in which unions are asking for more and businesses have to pay more to unions. So they have to charge more to consumers. And then like this thing kind of can go in a merry-go-round for that reason alone. And the only way to stop that is having a central bank that's disciplinary, right? Is to say that the way to keep that process at bay is for the central bank to be willing to raise interest rates more than proportionally in response to rises to inflation, right? And it takes that threat and that like aggression to be able to stave off that political spiral, that feedback loop. I think that is probably the way that I would fold up like all those ideas. So it's like people, they all got ahead of themselves. They all got so like caught up in expecting higher prices and higher wages, and that it just kept going. And Arthur Burns and G. William Miller and Paul, only until Paul Volcker, do you actually like, you needed to have someone to come in and lay the hammer down. And I think it's how I describe it, at least.
Right. And so all of this comes out of the 1970s and the trauma of that decade. But you've written about the inflation in the early 1950s, and you say, okay, this doesn't really seem to actually fit the pattern that we see there. So can you explain what was going on in the early 1950s and why you see a divergence from these explanations?
Yeah, so this is the this is where the story itself is already relying on a lot of, let me just to get the background for the 1970s. You had low unemployment in the late 1960s, inflation rises. They say, well, this is because of the Phillips curve. The unemployment rate's low, inflation's high. And then you see that the Fed did not raise interest rates enough to check inflation down. Because of that, inflation stays high. And the real lesson is the Fed should have been hiking rates to get inflation under control in the late 1960s. Because if you don't, then you get these spirals. And it just kept going for decades and decades. Because like unemployment went down below its natural rate, right? Unemployment down below its natural rate, time to start, like you need to be raising interest rates. And if you don't, like inflation expectations are going to get out of control. That kind of happened in the 50s, but inflation didn't get out of control. Unemployment fell to a really low level, lower than in the mid 1960s. Unemployment fell, inflation had a surge. That surge happened around the Korean War. It happened kind of front running a lot of wage and price controls that people were anticipating. So inflation went up to double digits in the early 1950s, and then it came down. And like, what's the disciplining device here? Interest rates barely moved. Like the Fed technically bumped up rates a little bit, but nothing nearly proportional to the surge in inflation. There was no Volcker shock that came in. So like, what's your story for how inflation just came down on its own? I've heard a couple things. I find them both to be incredibly post hoc in nature. One is that like the Fed Treasury Accord was this sort of confidence building, credibility inducing event that like kept businesses from like freaking out, or maybe kept some trade unions from freaking out. I find this like, I don't think the awareness about the Fed among businesses and trade unions really lines up with reality at that time. And so that's that part of it doesn't make sense. Then there's like the idea that the Johnson tax hikes are pretty important. That's not Johnson tax hikes. There were tax hikes of the in the mid 1950s that were somehow important. I I'm not really sure where that kind of fits into any kind of model of where the tax hikes end up curbing inflation. But I've heard like these kind of like, there's a lot like, to be clear, I've not actually heard a lot of this sort of like why the 1950s didn't end up becoming this inflation spiral on its own. Because what ended up happening was unemployment stayed low even as inflation came down, by the way. I should say that too. Right. So the Fed didn't do anything really. And inflation came down and the unemployment rate stayed low even after the inflation episode. Right. That's kind of the Goldilocks perfect story in that sense.
In that episode, did they did impose price controls to some extent during the Korean War. Is that right? Do you think that's a piece of it? Or?
Price and wage controls. So there is like, so price and wage controls put in, it has a pretty clearly obvious effect in the data. When they lift wage price controls, unlike the mid 1940s, you don't see the inflation rear its head again, right? So you don't see like that there's sort of pent up. It actually, and Eisenhower gets rid of them, but Eisenhower still keeps things like guideposts in place. And I think like, obviously there's a lot of rhetoric and debate now about like price controls and like how useful are they? And like the Isabella Weber, she had a pretty provocative Guardian op-ed, and a lot of mainstream economists saying, you're a bunch of idiots. Like even people like Salo, like a lot of famous economists in the 70s tried this and endorsed it and it failed. And it's like the reason I think a lot of people don't quite like grasp, like for a lot of people who said the wage price controls of the 70s, they endorsed them, probably saw a lot of what happened in the 50s and thought that was probably a success, right? We had wage and price controls. It seemed like wages, like inflation went down on its own afterwards and it just needed time to adjust, which is like, it didn't really like stop the flood of inflation in the 70s, right? The price and wage controls. So I think it's kind of like empirically, you can't say it did. You can say maybe it helped Nixon win an election, but it can't really say it's a, it's a particularly, it helps. Like, so there's clearly different things that were driving each. But I think it's like for either side who was trying to like argue about price controls and wage controls, it's like, it's kind of just, is like a little more depth as it would be helpful here, because like it actually did, like it at least coincided with what seemed like a policy success. Maybe it didn't have a lot to do with it, maybe it did, but it seemed like after they lifted wage and price controls in the 50s, you did not see inflation just surge. You actually saw something that looked pretty moderate. It did not seem to have much of enough, like unemployment still stayed really low. There was a recession. It wasn't particularly, I mean, it lost Nixon an election then, which there's a lot of in the late 1950s. But there's like a, we could use a little bit more nuance and a little bit more appreciation for history, because I actually don't think the existing theories of New Keynesian economics, New Keynesian does not, like, I don't know how much of your listeners are familiar with the strands of Keynesianism. Mm-hmm. I would not really call New Keynesian economics very Keynesian, but it is something that is the mainstream workhorse models of what central bankers use. And it kind of like boils down the two major sources of inflation to either be excessively low unemployment, which is kind of cringeworthy to say, or it's high inflation expectations. Those are the two things that are. And I think if you really look closely, like the fact that it kind of doesn't even hold up very well as a story, unless you're changing all your parameters all the time in very post hoc ways, in the 1950s, we should raise an eyebrow about what this stuff can really do.
Right. So unobservables have to be changing very quickly and sort of doing whipsaw conveniently, things, right? Like they have to be rising and then falling and then rising again in order to make everything make sense. Is inherently suspect, because no matter what the data do, you can always do that and then the equations fit. So if this kind of post hoc stuff is at least doesn't pass the smell test, methodologically speaking, what was behind the 1950s? What caused inflation to go up, and how did it check itself? Why was it self-canceling?
I think the biggest thing, this is where like causal inquiry is important, even though we can't be dispositive about it. And I think the causal inquiry that I think is fits the facts pretty well. It's like, look, you had a surge. Like if you look at the national accounts data here, a surge of defense spending, right? We had a huge amount of spending, a lot of anticipatory spending, probably some anticipatory price and wage increases ahead of the price controls and wage controls, which Truman really should have, if you were going to do it, like he kind of did it like after like everyone was kind of front running it. And like, that's kind of what I suspect Milton Friedman's whole speech about inflation expectations is kind of in reference to. It's like, there is a sort of anticipatory behavior. I don't think that actually lines up very neatly for the 1970s, but in the early 1950s, you saw both prices and wages, or labor income, I'll put it that way, instead of wages, because we don't have any great measures of wages at that time. Prices and labor incomes both co-move and surge coincidentally, such that there's like a lot of behavior that's moving in concert with like the surge in defense spending.
So there's another war.
And then defense spending stops, right? Like that's kind of something that's the other part of it, right? Defense spending stops, it even like goes down to some degree. And so that's like, it's a wartime story. And I think there was also some things that were probably different about the 50s if you think about the context of World War II, how much production and capacity had been built out for the wartime purposes, and how much, like on some categories, there was just overcapacity at that time. Oil and gas are largely in abundance in that decade.
So there are very specific world events that are sort of driving people to expect shortages. You know, maybe it's going to be World War II type conditions again. We should all go out and buy toilet paper just in case. Sort of reminds you of the early pandemic, right? And then something happens. They all it all evens out. Price controls get imposed. People chill out. The war ends. Inflation comes down.
Right. There's a lot of spending that was taking place that was either tied directly to the war or tied sort of more like it. Obviously, there's a lot of upstream production that's also tied to it that also stops, right? Like, this was not a long war, and also like political appetite was thinner for the war. And like, I'm not a Korean War scholar. I'm going to probably draw a line for myself here, but I think you see in the national accounts data that actually through the 1950s, especially after the war, so we had this like bulge of spending that ultimately kind of came down as the war was no longer like sort of a binding constraint or a binding force on spending behavior, right? So you have a lot of like, what's driving the spending is mm-hmm. kind of an important question to ask, I'd say, both in the 50s and the 70s.
Right. And so you noted that unlike the 1970s, the 1950s, there was an abundant energy supply, right? And that was an important binding constraint that in your story is driving the 1970s inflation. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think it's the only binding constraint, but I do think you see that like commodities and specifically oil, but not just oil, are like super cyclical. And what I mean by that is like it tends to be a decade of shortage and a decade of surplus or something along. Maybe some people say it's like 16 years. Some people tell you it's shorter, but like this is obviously not like, I don't believe in epicycles or anything like that, but I'm just but you do see that because it's very easy to build, like to get into positions of persistent overcapacity because these are typically uncoordinated phenomena in some ways, right? Like people are all trying to respond to current price signals or current incentives. It may not be price signals directly, but the current incentives to invest, but it takes time for investment to materialize into production and into returns. Mm-hmm. And so like, that's really the case for like 60s, 70s, like oil and gas, right? It takes like about 15 years to get like payoffs, right? So when the oil, like there are like conservation reports from like different interstate commissions that kind of report about this in the mid 60s, like we're kind of running low on some oil here. We're going to need more investment to be able to like have enough production online. But it was not the only place. And if you see like the cartelization movement of the 60s and 70s, you see like a lot of cartels formed around this period. Food, you see it in like everything, I think from like cocoa to maple syrup, you see it in tin, you see this in like a variety of different commodities. So like what's behind this, right? Like you see it show up. Why do you see that there is not enough? So there's like one, there's a global baby boom behind it, right? It's a global baby boom that's getting older, able to spend more. And that means that there's more demand for commodities, right? Like that's, I think, a big part of it too. And that demand for commodities is like a function of population growth at a time when they're moving closer and closer to years when they're going to start to work. And when they're going to work, they're also going to earn and they're going to spend. And that's just going to cause more capacity constraints to bind. Oil is probably the most important. Keep in mind, like manufacturing was dependent on oil at that time. There were a lot of oil input generators dependent on oil. Like it took a while for capacity to switch off of oil, things like coal in manufacturing. So like, yeah, these were all things that got pushed into pretty deep shortage as a function of population dynamics. Like, and like, look, there are like limits to how forward looking businesses are going to be about investment. I think that's a big part of it too, right? Like you can't, like, yes, in some ways it's a very sticky phenomenon and yet it still caused these problems. I think it could have been in some ways a perfectly forward looking actor might have been able to say, hey, these things are in shortage, we should be invested more. But oftentimes like, then that should actually necessitate a further inquiry into why that didn't happen to the extent it was needed.
So yeah. So a demographic boom causes key shortages in central commodity markets, which facilitates cartelization. And so in some sense helps.
I would say the cartelization part is just like a symptomatic of like, here's like, I'm just trying to tell you, obviously it's over a podcast, right? But it's like,
yeah,
this is like, these are stylized facts that are like interesting to say, like, why did all these things happen at these times?
I see.
Okay. Right? Like, why did we see cartels form so easily? And it's like, it's a lot easier to do that when like these things are, and capacity is actually tight. It's actually really hard to deliver for what people need. So you can like actually constrain production and not have to worry about a new entrant, and you don't have to worry about like scrambling to meet current demand, like as in like competing over existing demand. And that shows up in a few places there, which I think are, I would put the term symptomatic. I wouldn't say it's like the cartels caused it in some sort of
not cause,
like they're like the political cause of it. It's okay. Like, it's easier to do this stuff when like you have demand sort of outstrip supply on so many important areas. Maple syrup may not be the most important area, but like,
well, it's important to me since I'm from Minnesota, and you know we love our maple syrup up here. But okay, so then the key causal force in your story is the demographic growth, the unbelievable demographic growth of the baby boom generation. Okay.
Yeah, if I were to pair that with one other demographic dynamic, it's pretty important. Is the one-time surge of women earning market incomes, which is like one of the like the most subtly, I think, world historic kind of events. So we have women finally earning market household incomes.
Right.
So two income earners, that's a lot more in market income generated for the same amount of production. And obviously, like, it's not as if women were doing, like, we just don't count household production, right? You don't earn a market income for household production. It's there, it exists, it should be respected. But it's also like the kind of thing that we had a lot of market income generation of that. Job growth was enormous in the 1970s. That is the biggest irony of when we call things stagflation. You look at the actual growth rates and not forget about nominal dollar spending that's not inflation adjusted or whatever. Just look at the real growth in things like employment, the real growth in things like housing starts, housing permits, capital spending, investment in inflation adjusted terms. They're at their strongest decade in the 70s. The biggest irony of this, which is that there was a lot of investment. There was a lot of job growth. It just so happened the denominator was growing faster, right? So unemployment is a ratio of the unemployed to the labor force. And if you look at an employment to population ratio, it'd be employment relative to population. Population and labor force growth were running really strong during that decade, right? And we're talking about working age people who are probably entering their sort of prime earning years. That growth rate was quite substantial. So actually, there's a big irony is like, now we have like low unemployment and people want to say stagflation. Growth rate is also pretty strong, but it's not quite as strong as some of the years we had in the 70s in real terms. But in the 1970s, really when we say stagflation, we're just talking about the fact that unemployment was a lot higher than what most of society was used to in the 50s and 60s.
I mean, I think that's such a key point that this is about the denominator or largely about the denominator and not about, you know, it's not that jobs weren't being created. It's just like, you know, it seemed like there was not enough jobs to go around, but that was just because the number of people looking for work had suddenly gone up so much.
Yeah. And I think that's something that it's like a lot easier to get unemployment rate declines when the denominator, like if you look at even Japan now, right? Japan has a declining sort of working age population. And so it's actually at the margin, like even if jobs are the same, or if employment goes up even a smidge, like employment rates go up, unemployment rates really low in Japan now on a historic basis, right? So like in some ways that's like, I think we should care about unemployment rates and employment rates. I'm not here to tell you that. Like that's obviously important to me, but like it just goes to show like where the, like that's kind of gonna be a function of like what population growth looks like in the economy. And population growth, I think, also matters from the standpoint of like what tells you for labor market metrics, but also like, yeah, there's a lot of demand. You're probably going to add if you're talking about people who can work and who can spend money with their earnings.
Okay. So a lot of job growth and a lot of investment spending produces a lot more demand in the economy than ever has before. But that's also increasing supply, right? I mean, more workers means more people to build houses. So why isn't that disinflationary, and why doesn't that sort of perfectly offset it one for one so that you can just scale the economy by population size. I mean, why doesn't it work perfectly, Skanda?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, if I would love it to say that all employment is addressing the most immediate bottleneck, as someone who's a tight labor market advocate, I'd love to just tell you, like, yes, like all the employment is going to address the next bottleneck and then we'll have more capacity. And but like there's a latency issue, right? Like some people are going to go work in the Permian Basin and probably going to produce more oil, and that might help lower oil prices down the line, maybe a little sooner. And some people are going to work in professional services jobs, and those are probably not going to address like the most immediate bottleneck. They're important jobs, right? In some ways, some more than others, but like they are not doing the kind of thing that's going to necessarily immediately disinflate the deepest bottleneck, right? And on average, if you look at on like every first Friday of every month when the jobs report comes out, like there's a lot of jobs created, and not all of them are going to be in the most pressing areas in terms of where the most bottlenecked sectors. Or should they, to be honest, right? Like that's not like a reasonable way to, like, we're gonna like only have people work in oil and gas, or people work only in transportation and warehousing. Like, and they, I mean, there are people who say like labor supply is the key constraint. And therefore, if that was the best description of what's going on, then I guess you would say higher employment should actually be disinflationary at the margin. But it's just like, there are a lot of different sectors that are absorbing new people who are now able to earn an income and then able to spend. And that adds a lot of demand to final goods. One thing I would say about the 70s that was especially distinctive is it was not just that, it was that problem, that dynamic did create more final goods demand because investment itself was very labor intensive. There's a good paper by Justin Bloch on how much labor content was associated with, domestic labor content was associated with capital spending in the US. And that, not that, like the domestic labor content was very high in the 1970s because capital goods were largely produced within the US. And like we're associated with more labor intensive processes than we have now. Nowadays, most capital goods are produced overseas. I'd say most of the supply constraints we have right now are largely, if you think about automobiles, but even like a lot of other durable goods, they're key inputs. That are in shortage are things that are not really produced in the US, are kind of a function of a lot of policies that and dynamics that are like you'll find overseas for a variety of reasons. And so like when businesses need to invest, the downstream impact on labor income and the downstream impact of labor income onto final goods demand, so consumption demand, is weaker now than I think it was in the 70s. And so there's like a sort of amplifier there that I think doesn't really hold up. Maybe there's new mechanisms now, to be fair, like to be aware of. But I think part of the story of the 1970s is like you had a lot of investment that had to happen for supply to catch up with demand. And that investment itself was going to also add more demand in the short run. So eventually this stuff does like balance out because population isn't growing like exponentially forever in such a way that's so runaway. But like you are absorbing a lot of people over a decade to two decades. And like you're trying to make sure you give everyone like an ability to own a house or live in a house even, right? And so that's part of the 1970s story that I think people also forget with the terms of investment is like, if you look at the investment data from the national accounts, it looks like investment expanded quite substantially in a lot of really important areas. There's like energy production. So most of the stuff related to oil and gas, but also like that's when we built all our nuclear like power stations. We built a lot of this kind of stuff, both dirty and clean. And then we also did a lot of housing. I think that's actually one of the most settled successes of the 1970s. We built a lot of housing in the 1970s that was like relatively affordable. I mean, obviously there's like housing itself, like how energy intensive, how much of home ownership is good. I'm going to leave that aside for now. But I would just say like housing stock expanded enormously in that period of time. And we have not seen anything like that since the 1970s.
Right. And that's such a, I think, important part of the story that you tell is that this is like a one-time thing, right? So this is associated with the giant demographic boom after World War II that then hits all these capacity constraints, which requires labor-intensive forms of investment, which all is just like it's a cumulative process of demand where yeah. Everything is kind of leapfrogging over each other. And one of the key signatures that you draw out, right, is like okay, sure, manufacturing capacity utilization is low during the 1970s, but capacity utilization for mining is incredibly high as everyone is trying to produce more oil. Right? So there's clear bottlenecks that you're hitting and that we're seeing sort of return right now, right?
Yeah, you're seeing it large, like, I think that if I
not the same ones, obviously, but you know,
not the same ones, but there's an analogy here in terms of if you're a manufacturer, you had a bunch of capacity in the 1970s for automakers, right?
Right.
They had the capacity to produce, but they didn't produce. And why didn't they produce? Was it because of weak demand? Well, maybe, but like also part of it was like, yeah, input costs were really high. The cost of like running your plant was really high. And like if you needed energy, it was at a premium. And so mining is like the bind, like part of like thinking about granular supply constraints, stuff that won't, like, I think a lot of macroeconomists too easily say is a labor supply constraint because they're just trying to collapse down and reduce information to such a degree that they are missing what's actually important. Like it wasn't the lack of labor. It was the lack of ability to like have rigs and wells. And obviously, like, by the way, I'm talking a lot about oil and gas. I'm not here to tell you about like oil and gas is good today or something like that. I am here to tell you that like oil and gas was in shortage in the 1970s. It took a long time to invest. There was a ton of investment that happened. Right. If you notice that in the 1980s, a lot of states that have really elevated employment during the Reagan years were all oil states. So Colorado, Louisiana, Alaska, Texas, Oklahoma, these are all states that actually had pretty high unemployment during that period. And they had their big booms during the 1970s. And so like, this is a historical point. It's like, there was a lot of investment that had to happen, and oil and gas like was really important as an input because that was where the capacity constraint really did bind. Right. And once that binds, like everything kind of binds, like there's no like obvious substitute in terms of energy. At least you have to build the capacity to substitute, which itself is not easy over time. Like there's more reliance on coal. There's more reliance on other sources of energy for electricity. Then oil becomes more of just an exclusive transportation fuel. There's like an ability to produce a lot more oil by the end of that decade.
To what extent is the end of that inflation then the result of deliberate macroeconomic policy to cool down labor markets versus a decade of trying to route ourselves around these bottlenecks and actually succeeding by the mid 1980s? So to what extent can we actually give Volcker the credit here?
I think you can give Volcker the immediate credit of saying that, I think of him as, like, if you want to, like, put labels on the story, like, it's true that he, like, his shock forced a recession that drastically cooled down labor markets, and by cool, I mean put them in the freezer. Male employment, like, really did not recover out of that at all. Manufacturing employment really did not recover. We did have a little bit of a construction boom in 83, 84, but like there was like some permanent damage. It took a long, like unemployment rates didn't really recover. So like in some ways it was viewed as success purely on the terms of like inflation did go down.
Right.
There's also like a global, like it set off the Latin American debt crisis.
Volcker has his dark sides as well. I'm credit in the sense of like
I'm just here to say like those, like we shouldn't be denialists that those things probably also cooled down inflation.
Okay. Right?
Like we should just be clear that all these things are also disinflationary.
Got it.
But I would say the reason oil prices also peaked in 1980 and why they kept going down throughout the decade and why inflation was able to be pretty well behaved throughout that decade. Paul Volcker probably stole a lot of glory from Texas oil men and Alaskan oil men, right? Like, there's a little bit of like glory theft going on. We could celebrate like all the people who made all the investments that increased capacity, agricultural capacity. Keep in mind, it's not just an energy phenomenon. There was like also a lot of food shortages. Your listeners might want to read up on the Great Grain Robbery when Soviets kind of managed to out negotiate Nixon on. sort of the need for grain going to the Soviet Union because they had a big famine or drought, I should say famine, and lower grain production. So like these things are all, it took a lot of investment to get out of there through like on a sustained basis. And it also took like population growth also kind of cooled off after we kind of absorbed it, right? So it was a one-time phenomenon, as you said, but it was like, it was a decade to two decade, the 10 to 15 year phenomenon is probably a more accurate reflection. Now, how do I, like, My story is also one that is a little like convenient, you could say. You can't really identify when the population shock translates into inflation because it's like a very slow moving process. But I'll say, like, you can look at other countries now in terms of population growth. And you can see like which places have higher inflation, lower inflation. You kind of get a very similar, like, it's at least consistent with the hypothesis where you see Japan has really slow / negative population growth. And it also translates into, or it coincides, I should say, and with like very low inflation outcomes, right? The capacity in the core areas has largely been built out. And it's just a question of asset maintenance, which is a little bit different from trying to build out like all this oil production capacity. And oil itself is really hard to produce. And like, you have to explore. It takes a long time in the 1970s, not quite true nowadays, but 1970s, it took a long time to be able to figure that stuff out. I think that a lot of uncertainty also attached to it. So yeah, I would say that's also part of the story that people miss out on. But Paul Volcker, I think it would be silly to say he didn't cause inflation. It's just like, it's a pretty ugly version of disinflation, but sure enough, he kind of helped to ratchet it down. Would it have gone down even in the absence of Paul Volcker is a more interesting question. Right. And my story is one that is more consistent with inflation would have come down. Mm-hmm. You didn't need to do a mass Volcker shock to achieve that outcome. But look, a decade's a long time to tell people like it's going to end, or like, and that's part of like, how do you build a political coalition and trust that, like, in a way, whether for better or worse, like the solution to inflationary challenges in a market economy, absent central bank laying down the hammer, is to like rely on capitalism, right? It's to say like a bunch of people who are going to like invest and overinvest and going to create the capacity and going to risk overcapacity to get to sort of abundance.
Would it be possible in your mind to have a proactive policy that identifies these potential bottlenecks and tries to solve them in advance? Namely, could we look at like the input output tables and see what are the central sort of nodes in the economy and then try to cross-reference that with which ones have like short-term capacity constraints and try to invest in those beforehand so that we don't hit them, or that, you know, there's a sort of more smooth expansion, or is that too difficult to try to do?
I think it's finely balanced, right? Where you have to be humble enough to admit that there are going to be areas that are necessarily blind spots, and you have to have some method of just allowing for response mechanisms. But you do see if you look at Japan, which was sort of in its developmental boom in the 1970s too, right? And they had initially very high inflation, and then over time inflation went down. I don't think monetary policy is actually a great explanation for Japan's like inflation. Like, I think it's better described in terms of industrial policy. But that's probably, yeah, we're probably getting to the edge of what we can say, claim with strong certainty here. But Japan is an economy in which you have some degree of foresight. Even now, there's a lot of state push for them for like more investment in natural gas, to make sure that the natural gas is not in short supply. Like, that's something that like the Japanese government is putting some pressure on right now, because they're worried that a lot of businesses in their pursuit of like energy transition are going to kind of do things in a really fragile way. So there's some level of careful planning. If you look at the energy transitions that happened that have happened, they were in the 1970s. I think the two that come to mind are France and Quebec, where Quebec built out a lot of hydroelectric capacity, and France nuclear, right? So yeah, I think there is. I think part of it though is just to be a little bit humble about like how much combined, and ultimately it's about like there are some businesses or governments that are going to have some level of like, I think it helps for government to play a productive informational like collation and gathering and coordination role, at least. That's a pretty safe place to start. And like, ultimately, if it's done right, it's ultimately complementary to the efforts of businesses that probably don't like, I think like the saying in commodities is like high price, the cure to high prices is higher prices. So higher prices kill off demand and increase incentive to unearth supply. I think it's like, it's kind of true on like a marginal sense. It's like, you don't want to give it too much credit to say it's going to like always solve every problem in the nicest way, but it is like probably marginally helpful. But like, to the extent you can actually, if we're going to have a
market-oriented capitalist system, which is like, I don't think that's changing anytime immediately. I think we have to be a little bit like smarter about how we think about how government could play a pretty helpful, at least information gathering role that I think at least would have been helpful. I said this earlier, there was like, I can pull this up for you from conservation reports from like interstate commissions that like in the mid 1960s, like oil and gas community was actually pretty focused on conservation. Like they had, and so like they had a very, like they were probably among the most clear eyed about the challenges associated with like, we're running out of like, we're running out of oil here. We're not producing as much as we used to. We're going to have to invest a lot more than we're currently investing is kind of the message in like 1964 or 1965. So like that's a kind of helpful thing. If you can kind of do that at a level, can you always do that for every single input, every single thing? Probably not, but like part of like good state capacity building and good bureaucracy building is also about like learning. And it's like also about figuring out like, these are the blind spots. How do we incorporate them? How do we make sure that the chip shortage isn't fine again? What are other sorts of types of shortages that are similar to chip shortages? I should have probably mentioned, you asked this question before, it's like analogous to now where auto capacity utilization has been idled because of the absence of microchips, which are produced largely overseas, I would say, or not always overseas, but they are produced in large part overseas. And so like the chip bottlenecks are largely in Asia, and yet they've idled a lot of capacity. So the capacity utilization has really fallen off. And like right now, it's like, yeah, that's kind of hit inflation and hit the economy in a pretty meaningful sense. It's probably a big chunk of inflation, even if it's not its totality of why inflation surged currently. And so like, what could government do better here? It's hard to say in a very like local sense, but like information gathering, best practice identification, these are all like good starting points, I would say, for how you can help to, like ultimately, it's not been great for GM or Ford to really have to deal with this to begin with. And so to the extent that they probably stand to benefit from having some complementary capabilities in this regard.
Yeah, it seems like policy kind of jumps in as soon as, policy often jumps in after the fact, after these supply constraints have been identified. And private sector actors then come out of the woodwork complaining about it and the need for action, right? So is that... Yeah, but I still feel like there should be some more general institutionalized way, you know, building state capacity, if you will, to sort of get out ahead of this.
Yeah, I think that's hopefully the right answer to some of these things. Something that my colleague I didn't mean to cut you off. I'll just jump in with like my colleague Arnav that has kind of been helping sort of formulate along with some, like with the. Chris Coons' office, Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, for having kind of an investment and its informational gathering capacity around sort of key areas of bleeding edge tech-like investment, where there may be like leading edge technologies that are just not investable in the present, but also areas of like supply chain resilience, where you actually do want to have key investments be made. And part of that is like, meant to be just ultimately complementary, right? Like it's, these things are forward-looking and they're meant to be able to identify the next place where there's like room for investment. Whether that investment is to kind of buttress the lagging edge or because the bleeding edge, the areas between like sort of raw scientific R&D or raw scientific research is not yet at the stage where it's mature enough for commercialization or not like not investable commercialization. Where there's like room for that kind of stuff. So I think there's like these kinds of proposals to kind of move in that direction. And that's kind of a critical part of how do you build that? I think that's actually something, if you look at Japan, they actually have that kind of capacity. If you look at least more so, some people look at Japan as a failure because like their raw economic growth rate stagnated, but actually in per capita terms, they're doing just fine. Like they've managed to like actually been quite a success story despite stagnant demographics, GDP, employment, all those categories on a per capita basis looks great. And part of like why I think they've managed to manage so much of that pretty well is like they do have some further forward-looking planning abilities. It's pretty nested and embedded also with the private sector too. So I don't think of this as being a like we can talk about like whether this stuff should be public, should be private, whether like barriers, but the notion that this stuff can't exist in the US system is probably a little too cynical.
This is a slight shift gears, but so we've just been talking a lot about ways the government can help reduce inflation or identify these supply constraints and just sort of like what can be done, you know, how to deal with it. And I mean, one thing that hasn't come up a ton is the Fed, right? I feel like that's what many people think of as like the way that you deal with inflation is through the Fed. And so I'm curious, I mean, I think there's sort of, you've outlined a lot of reasons why that's not the only way or the best way or even that useful of a way to go about it. But do you see the Fed as having a role in preventing inflation? And maybe also why, you know, if not, why is it so common for people to think that?
Oh yeah, it's a lot to break off. I think that the Fed has, so that's like, the Fed has had a dual mandate for maximum employment. I call it a dual mandate, there is a third part of it, but I think it kind of ends up being a little bit like, I don't know how seriously how to take that necessarily, but it's mostly about maximum employment and stable prices, right? And moderate long-term interest rates, that's the third part. Presumably moderate long-term interest rates are a function of achieving those two mandates. Maximum employment and stable prices are kind of like, they've not really been taken, the maximum employment part has not really been taken seriously, whereas the stable prices part was taken really seriously. And ironically, it was called the Humphrey-Hawkins full employment, like full employment is in the title of the act in 1978 when it gets passed. And it was like a long push to kind of get the Federal Reserve to focus on full employment too. And the Federal Reserve, after that legislation got passed, pretty much ignored it, right? Did not take that part seriously. But it did take stable prices like very seriously, as if that is the foundation and bedrock on which everything else is based and everything that they do is based. But there's a causality issue that's really problematic, right? Which is, how does the Fed actually control inflation? There is the very crude monetarist view that has been, that is just wrong. And I think this is where post-Keynesian economics is very good at pointing out why it is wrong, that the Fed does not print money. The Fed does not control the supply of the money that you and I transact in any like functional sense. That is something that is largely decentralized, left up to the private sector. And it's not something that the Fed can like easily pull in or pull out of like the amount of money that's in the economy. They do not control that money supply. They control something really narrow in terms of quantities. What the Fed actually controls are short-term interest rates. Short-term interest rates feed through to longer-term interest rates on particular securities, pretty well, like treasury yields. But then when it comes to like corporate borrowing costs, asset prices at large, the Fed has like varying degrees of influence, right? It has some influence on some reliable basis, and some influence is pretty time-varying, episodic, kind of a function of a lot of different things happening at once. So like you'll see sometimes where markets will sell off dramatically in response to the Fed raising interest rates, and other times when the Fed's raising interest rates, it doesn't matter at all, right? So like we have to kind of be cautious about what we can say with reliability here. On the actual demand to inflation side, you can't really say a lot of reliable things there either. There's not a lot of components that are particularly connected to inflation on a reliable business cycle basis. So like, you would think that when cyclical pressures are really strong, you'd see certain prices would generally move in lockstep. Turns out most prices don't behave that way, but there's like a few that do, like food and rent. And it's like food and rent are not really a function of credit flows. It's not about how much credit is being created in the economy. It's not about like food and rent are like consumed by the poorest people in largest share. So they're not typically the ones who have like big equity portfolios that if those go down, they're going to cut back on consumption, right? So like ultimately, yes, asset prices, wealth effects, credit creation all matter, but like they ultimately were down, like they must kind of have some downstream impact that's hitting prices really, if we think about it. That downstream impact, I think, has to run through the labor market. Maybe not the only mechanism, I don't want to say necessarily or exclusively, but like the dominant mechanism is really about slowing down labor market. Like that's it. Would you want to structure policy that way? Ideally, no. Right? You would like to try and like avoid, I think there's got to be some flexibility about like how interest rates should be matched up with the nominal income growth rate of the economy. In the 1970s, nominal GDP was really strong too, right? Like nominal GDP growth, nominal income growth was pretty strong. Capital spending, we talked about earlier, is really strong. So it wasn't just inflation that was strong through that period. It wasn't just like there were price increases. There was price increases coupled with a big sort of spending response and spending boom. Not one-to-one, not even proportional necessarily, coincident, I should say. So we saw you'd see oil prices go up, go down. Nominal GDP growth might have its boom in a couple of years, right? But you saw that the elevated rates of nominal GDP growth, elevated rates of nominal income growth, elevated rates of labor income growth in a nominal basis. And so, yeah, the Fed can have some influence. Is this the best way to do policy? Even if you thought the answer to the problems of inflation were always to suppress household demand, you might want to design. It's true the Fed has unique discretion, and maybe you only have a certain, go into each episode with the tools you have, not the tools you want. But if we were thinking a little more abstractly, would we want to find better tools even for household demand suppression? Like you could do things that actually suppress demand in some direct ways. You could find ways to to raise taxes if you really wanted to be or if you thought that there were ways to actually could suppress household demand through raising their deposit rates or finding ways to right now when the Fed raises rates, it's not like they're raising your deposit rate. Your deposit rate's probably not going up. And unless you're actively managing your savings where you're going to switch your money into a money market fund, you're probably going to just take, you're not seeing any of that in terms of I'm going to save more because the Fed raised their interest rate. Maybe I'll go change my portfolio allocation if I'm of means to do so to own more bonds or whatever, or hold more shorter term interest rate products. But that's a pretty select group of households. And it's not the kind of thing that's slowing down demand in a direct way. So we could think a little bit more creatively about that if that's really where we want to go. And that may not be the answer to suppress household demand, in part because if you're really trying to encourage incentives for supply to materialize, the greater the confidence that demand is going to stay there is also part of what you need to see ultimately. And so if I think that the kind of boom in spending is more one time in nature, of the boom in demand is going to abate, that should also affect how businesses respond. If businesses are going to have to constantly decide between whether to ramp up capital spending and capacity to meet current and future demand with the other constraint on their sort of bottom line, which is liquidity preference, right? If I go splurge on a bunch of CapEx and the next day I find out that the demand wasn't there, I'm stuck. I spent a bunch of money on real assets that are of little to no use. And I don't have a lot of liquidity left to weather the next financial shock. Right. So I think that's kind of the tension of inflation management and how much do you want to allow these processes to actually play out? And how much do you want to let these, at least in a market oriented capitalist system, I'd say. And that there is a tension. There's a political tolerance to that kind of phenomenon too, to be honest. So I think we should, if we were trying to think blue sky thinking about what's the right way to do this, would we try to rely on the Fed on inflation? Probably not. I will say the Fed kind of immediately seems to recognize this now a little bit more. They talk a lot about a flat Phillips curve. A flat curve in this sense is really just either there's no relationship between unemployment and inflation, or what you're really saying is the influence is very tiny. And if we're really honest, the Fed has a lot more influence over the labor market than it does over inflation itself. The Fed it can be true that the Fed's influence runs to the labor market. But we can also say the Fed's influence over the labor market is a lot more reliable than the Fed's influence over inflation itself. In terms of proximity, I would rank them financial conditions first, labor market second, inflation third. And I think that flat Phillips curve is pretty consistent with that. It could be consistent with other interpretations too, but I think it's pretty clear to me that the Fed's influence over inflation is very oblique, perverse if you care about keeping labor markets reasonably tight and keeping labor market outcomes improving over time. And yeah, it's kind of the discretionary price inflation tool. There's a legal mandate to do so. I think that should be taken somewhat seriously, even if it's not something I would think is ideal. But if we could go back and design things differently, we'd probably want to think a little bit more seriously about other methods for affecting inflation, whether it's through the household demand side or try to find other supply side
or even more directed channels, right? So we can think about areas where the government can spend less or spend more stingily, and that would actually lead to, like, there's a lot of healthcare providers that rely on the government spending to set prices, and the government could draw a harder line on some things.
Healthcare. So this is Medicare as industrial policy.
Yeah, it's a kind of Medicare as industrial policy. I think it's the kind of thing that probably some fiscal hawks might actually like find some of my views a little more sympathetic. Like, healthcare costs are pretty enormous in this country as a pure GDP, pretty enormous. Like, and there's a whole complex of interests that are particularly motivated to extract as much as they can from the government. That redounds to higher prices in both some direct senses because these prices are administered, but also some indirect senses because, like, private payers on healthcare also set their costs based on like what they see the government's able to extract. So as a bet, like, I'm probably speaking a little fast and loose here, but yeah. So if the government draws a harder line, if the government decides to spend less in particular areas, they're usually able to exercise more bargaining power, and private payers for of healthcare to providers also seem to are able to set their prices accordingly and in response to what the government's able to achieve in terms of lower prices. We saw this somewhere, like, there's a Chicago Fed piece about this. There's actually a San Francisco Fed piece about how certain Medicare policies changed in the 2010s and that actually had a low effect of lowering healthcare inflation. You could imagine, on the demand side, if you wanted to get like sectoral about it, there are other areas where the government influences spending, higher education being a very, is one where like you could imagine government being a little bit more take a more fine tooth comb to how it affects demand for services. And on the supply side, like getting more imaginative there, it's kind of challenging. Maybe you could think of some areas where government could facilitate more quality adjusted price improvements. You could think about where the government could do some things that could matter. Mind you, all the things I'm saying here are all kind of semi-blasphemous because to people who think inflation is this purely general equilibrium phenomenon. There's a general price level, like managing all these like minutiae will never get at the real problem. All I'll say back to that is like there's certainly some modicum of truth to that, but like the Fed looks at Fed and most Fed macroeconomic observers usually look at core inflation. They don't look at headline inflation. So food and energy prices are clearly places where like micro economics matters, and there is no general price level, and we tend to assume these price changes to be transitory. So I realize this is kind of an intense area, and maybe I'm getting a little too in the weeds, but it's one of those things where, food and energy prices, if food prices and energy prices go down, wouldn't like demand just shift to somewhere else if the prices went up, food and energy? And it's like, not quite. Like, it's not the case that just because like you take control, like influence one set of prices, that another set of prices are going to respond and offset what you're doing. I guess that's what I would just like. But it is something that's probably more controversial in a lot of economic circles.
So we're nearing the end of our time here, but just to wrap it up, I mean, what do you make of the general sense and tenor of the policy discussion over the past, let's say, two and a half years since the pandemic started? A lot of people are talking about Biden as, Biden is selling himself, right, as an FDR-sized presidency. And we've seen massive fiscal stimulus. We've seen fairly ambitious attempts to influence labor markets in a positive and tight way. I mean, the group of post-Keynesian economists who are actively working in DC is fairly small, but do you see these kinds of ideas gaining steam, or is it still a fairly small community as of yet? Or would you just totally disagree with my characterization of the tenor of policy discussion?
I don't know about the tenor of the policy discussion. It's kind of like we're in a really volatile macroeconomic time, right? The data is super volatile. The people who are now people are really worried about inflation. Whereas if you talk to people 12 months ago, 13 months ago, 14 months ago, they're talking about how we're going to avoid a long protracted recovery. Even 6 to 7 months ago, this course was about disincentives among people who are unemployed. I don't know if I see anything that suggests to me a deep paradigm shift. I see a lot of people who are
Yeah, I think that most people are on the margins of maybe have shaded their views a few ticks from where they might have been 5, 6, 10 years ago. But I don't know if I would like go so far to be telling you that the revolution has started or something in terms of intellectual development of macro. I think part of it, we are going to come out of this, and I think it's going to be interesting to see in 12 to 18 months or so. One, I wouldn't be surprised if the narrative has shifted again from sort of an inflation obsession to something else. And even if it's inflation, it will probably shape a lot of people's thoughts about what's possible. So I think I do think of this as probably being a pretty high leverage year for like what that arc is, for what people who work in policy circles think is possible. There's already people are talking about how this is effectively a wage price spiral. I don't think that's a great description, but I do think that's something that people are sort of reckoning with right now.
Yeah, I guess now that I'm thinking more about the question, I mean, there was that NYT piece about MMT taking a victory lap, and there's a lot of pushback by economists that they didn't like that very much.
Yeah,
I guess maybe I was overstating the progress or the changes that have been made.
Let me put it this way. I think sure. The fact that discussion you saw, whether it was online or the people who were quoted for it, for better and worse, I'm not sure it's like leading to more deliberative tendencies. I don't think that's necessarily making people think more about what is and what isn't right. You had like Larry Summers saying like MMT is bad, but listen to these other posts, take the Marxists and the post-Keynesians more seriously. This is it's a big jumbled mess, and like no one's really clear about what claims they're standing on, what they're evaluating. Like, I think you will probably see, because in like, let's see where interest rates like sort of peak out in this kind of next 2 years. We'll probably have a good idea of like where interest rates are trending or where they peaked out. Like one of the things that scared a lot of people for a generation was that interest rates were going to skyrocket if like the government did an ounce of more spending. And that part of the hypothesis for like crowding out and all that stuff does not look very strong, right? It's like, and so if you can tell a made up story about how it's R star, there's R star being like the natural rate of interest, the secret rate of interest at which everything equilibrates is actually a lot lower than we previously thought. Or you can say like, the Fed has a lot of control over where like interest rates ultimately end up, right? And I think that latter view is pretty strong. Now, what do you do about inflation? I don't think anyone's got a great idea of this stuff. I think that's actually a much messier picture and one where Fed unilateralism is pretty entrenched, I'd say, but like hopefully we can start to like, I think that's where probably there needs to be like a deeper elaboration of like how does Fed policy work. We've kind of been sitting in, just to tie this full circle to what we were saying start this podcast, there's a big faith in expectations doing a lot of work, but it's never really clear what people are expecting. And I think that's like, if we're clear about it, that what's really happening is that businesses and households are expecting the economy to slow down and the labor market to slow down, maybe we'll start to think a little harder about like, how do we manage these tensions better?
All right. Well, here's to more deliberation on macro policy. Thank you, Skanda, for joining us. This has been, I think, really enlightening. And we'll link to all of those posts that you mentioned in the show notes. So thank you so much.
Happy to be on.
Reviving Growth Keynesianism is produced by me, Nick Johnson. If you enjoyed this discussion, please follow us wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and consider leaving us a positive review, which will help us connect with more engaged listeners like you. More information on our ideas can be found at revivinggrowthkeynesianism.org. There you can also find our Patreon. We would greatly appreciate if you chose to support us. All donations allow us to put out more content for thoughtful listeners like you. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.